California City. Praise God. That video is just really tough to follow. I thought I'd be over it after the first sermon, but whoever was eating onions during the first sermon was also eating them in the second. So, we're in a series right now called Life Change from the Heart. And if this is your first time attending, your first sermon you're hearing, I really recommend that you go to the church website and listen to the sermon before this, because that'll help you understand what we're talking about here, the framework and everything that's led up to today. So have any of you ever noticed that throughout the Gospels, Jesus seems to seek out companionship of what society calls the sinners? These seem to be the people he invites to be his friends. And it doesn't stop with the sinners. He even surrounds himself with those traitors, those betrayers who've chosen to serve the occupying Roman army by collecting taxes for them, the tax collectors. These seem to be the people he looks for. It's kind of weird. We don't really hear much about Jesus seeking out those people who devote themselves to his law. Though counterintuitive, these seem to be the people receiving the heaviest of his chastisement. I think the heart of his chastisement is really a concern for something called spiritual blindness. I think the essence of spiritual blindness, as well as its opposite, are best conveyed in Luke 7, verses 36 to 50. When one of the Pharisees invited Jesus to have dinner with him, he went to the Pharisee's house and reclined at the table. A woman in that town who lived a sinful life learned that Jesus was eating at the Pharisee's house. So she came there with an alabaster jar of perfume. As she stood behind him, at his feet weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears. Then she wiped them with her hair, kissed them, and poured perfume on them. When the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, "If this man were a prophet, he would know who is touching him, what kind of woman she is, that she's a sinner." Jesus answered him, "Simon, I have something to tell you." "Tell me, teacher," he said. "Two people owed money to a certain moneylender. One owed him 500 denarii and the other 50. Neither of them had the money to pay him back, so he forgave both their debts. Now which one of them will love him more?" Simon replied, "I suppose the one who had the bigger debt forgiven." "You've judged correctly," Jesus said. Then he turned toward the woman and said to Simon, "Do you see this woman? I came into your house. You did not give me any water for my feet, but she wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You did not give me a kiss, but this woman from the time I entered has not stopped kissing my feet. You did not put oil on my head, but she has poured perfume on my feet. Therefore, I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven, as her great love has shown. But whoever has been forgiven little, loves little." Then Jesus said to her, "Your sins are forgiven." The other guests began to say among themselves, "Who is this who even forgives sins?" Jesus said to the woman, "Your faith has saved you. Go in peace." So which of the two people in debt do you think represents the sinful woman? The one who owed more, right? Her debt, it's obvious. She knows she must have been forgiven a lot. Her sins are the kind that are obvious. In the parable, the one who's forgiven debt is greater, experiences grace in a deeper sense than the one who is forgiven a little. Likewise, the sinful woman knows she's been forgiven of a great debt. And because of this, her experience of grace is also deeper. How powerful is this experience? How does it move her? What does it lead her to do? Her great love shows it. She wet his feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. From the time he entered, she doesn't stop kissing his feet. She pours perfume on his feet. Now, that's a pretty deep experience of grace. It's the kind of experience that I want. I want to be moved like that. So then, who does the one who owed a little represent? Simon the Pharisee, right? He hasn't sinned like her in the obvious ways. As far as he knows, he only needs to be forgiven a little. his debt must be less than that sinful woman's, right? Consequently, what is his experience of grace like? What does it move him to do? Though he does invite Jesus into his home, he's not even moved enough to greet him with a kiss on the cheek. Even though he knows Jesus' feet are probably tired and sandy from walking around in those Birkenstocks all day, he doesn't even offer him anything to clean or refresh them. Do you think Jesus is trying to suggest that do-gooders like Simon, even though they invite Jesus into their homes, is he suggesting that they should experience grace in a way that's uninspiring? Are they being punished just because they only sin a little? Because they're good? Not a chance. This can't be the case. Remember, the Apostle Paul says that we're all under the power of sin. No one is good. No one is righteous. And Jesus says we're all slaves to sin. We're all more messed up than we could ever know. In telling Simon this parable, I think that Jesus might be giving Simon a gentle warning about spiritual blindness. So what should Simon do about his spiritual blindness? And what about those of you who, like Simon, can't really relate to those sinner type? The alcoholics, the addicts, the adulterers. What about those of you who don't struggle with indulging the desires of the flesh because, you know what, it's not just your thing? Are you doomed to spiritual blindness? Or is there something else you could do? What could it be? So that you too can experience grace like the sinful woman. You can clean the inside of the cup, right? Last week, I said that this is exactly what Jesus told the Pharisees and the teachers of the law to do as he was lashing out to them for their spiritual blindness, for their hypocrisy. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You clean the outside of the cup and dish, but inside they are full of greed and self-indulgence. Blind Pharisee! First, clean the inside of the cup and dish, and then the outside will also be clean. In last week's sermon, I described this cup cleaning process as one consisting of four elements. After briefly going through these, I gave a little demo to help express what this cup cleaning process is really about. How it's really just a practical application for devoting more and more of our hearts to God. The first thing we had to do was learn what the dirtying elements are inside of the cup. And I said we had to ask a teacher to help us examine the cup for these things, to take inventory of everything that we find. Now, you'll remember that I said the inside of the cup represents the heart, the outside represents behavior, which you can see. Anything inside the cup represents something that we love. And the dirtying elements, those represent the forms of self-indulgence that we're to look for. So next, I share this with my teacher, my findings, that is, so that he can help me sharpen my examination, help me find even more. And in addition to sharing with him, I'm also sharing it with God, because the reality is he's the only one who can cleanse the cup. Let's leave a little bit inside. So to show God that I'm serious about devoting the inside of my cup to him, I stop filling it with even more Play-Doh. And then I humbly ask him to fill it with his grace, so that that is the experience of my heart. So the more space that I create inside the cup, the more room there is to be filled by God's grace. The more I find, the better. I want to experience forgiveness by the moneylender for as much debt as possible. I want to experience grace like the sinful woman. I want to experience the byproduct of the Spirit in a way that's transforming, in a way which frees me from the enslavement of gratifying the desires of the flesh. That's a spiritual experience. I think that to declare Jesus as Lord without cleaning the inside of the cup is exactly what spiritual blindness is. It's to go on believing that my debt is small and that I don't need to look any further than the obvious sins that I don't even do, because that's not my thing. It's to approach the topic of lordship by focusing on the outside of the cup, the part that others can see. I think approaching lordship in this way is the very foundation, the platform from which spiritual hypocrisy, arrogance, and self-righteousness are enacted. So what does it really mean to examine one's heart for idolatry, the sin beneath the sin? That sounds really abstract and churchy to me. Well, last week, I gave you the answer that Bill W. and Dr. Bob learned from the Oxford group and that they used to write as their fourth step. But today, I want you to find the answer the way that I did. That is, after I was led through the 12 steps, I spent some time poring through the Bible, looking to reverse engineer the term spiritual experience, recovery. I wanted to reverse engineer this from the 12-step framework back into its biblical origins. And as it relates to this particular step and the cup cleaning process, there was one passage that really jumped out to me in Matthew 7, verses 15 to 17. Watch out for false prophets. They come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ferocious wolves. By their fruit you will recognize them. Do people pick grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? Likewise, every good tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot bear bad fruit, and a bad tree cannot bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown in the fire. Thus, by their fruit, you will recognize them. So the context of this passage refers to recognizing a person according to their fruit, the fruit that fills their heart. Because inevitably, you're going to see it on the outside. Because if you clean the inside of the cup, the outside will be clean. But what struck me about this passage, though, was the truth about a good tree only being able to produce good fruit, and a bad tree only being able to produce bad fruit. What do you guys think this good fruit is? Question number one. If the good fruit were a metaphor for the byproduct of something, what might it represent? It represents the fruit of the Spirit, right? Love, joy, peace, kindness, goodness, gentleness, faithfulness, and self-control. Probably skipped one there. If the good tree were a metaphor for something which produces good fruit, what might it represent? Worshiping Christ, the true vine. John 15, 5 says, I am the vine, you are the branches. If you remain in me and I in you, you will bear much fruit. Question 3. If the good fruit represents the Spirit's fruit, you guys got to fill in the blank, all right? Then the bad fruit must represent the blank of the Spirit's fruit. What word do you think fits in there? The opposite of the Spirit's fruit, right? Opposite of bad fruit is opposite good fruit. These are things like hatred, discord, jealousy, fits of rage, selfish ambition, dissension, and indignation. Question 4. If the good tree represents our worship of Christ, the true vine, then what might the bad tree represent? Survey says self-worship or self-indulgence. Hey, wait a minute. Isn't that what we're trying to learn about here? What we're trying to find? So there's two observations that we note from this passage. One, when I'm adoring Christ, when I'm in the vine, in worship, in the Spirit, the bad fruit cannot be present in those moments. Just the fruit of His Spirit. A good tree cannot bear bad fruit. The second observation, when I'm adoring myself, when I am given to self-indulgence in whatever form, only the bad fruit can be present in those moments. The good fruit cannot. Likewise, a bad tree bears bad fruit. A bad tree cannot bear good fruit. This is actually really good news because I want to examine my heart for the idols of self-indulgence, but I don't know what the heck self-indulgence looks like. However, I do know what bad fruit looks like. I can easily spot that in my life. So if I want to take inventory of all the times that self-indulgence was present in my life, I can do so by starting with an inventory of all the times I experienced the bad fruit. I can use this as a sneaky backdoor entry to find self-indulgence because I know that each time the bad fruit is present, I know it spawned from self-indulgence. Within the 12-step framework, this is exactly what the fourth step is about. It's an inventory of resentment with an emphasis on the forms of self-indulgence that underlie it. Now, generically speaking, I think it's okay to refer to the bad fruit as resentment. Consider some common dictionary definitions of the word. Resentment, indignation or ill will, felt as the result of a real or imagined grievance. A feeling of indignant displeasure or persistent ill will at something regarded as wrong, insult or injury. The state of holding something in the mind as a subject of contemplation or of being inclined to reflect upon something, a state of consciousness, conviction, feeling, impression. In the book that we use in our recovery ministry, meets on Fridays, 5:30 to 6:30, church office, we use a generic definition to define resentment, which kind of reflects these three definitions. Resentment, any feeling of discomfort which lingers in the mind as the subject of contemplation. So this self-examination is an examination of all the times in your life, all of them, in which you experienced some form of discomfort which lingered in the mind as the subject of contemplation. Now, if you're a normal human being, like some of you are, you're probably going to be writing a lot then. This is a heavy task. When my sponsor first hit me with the reality of this step, his suggestion to me was to write for an hour every day until I could think of nothing more to write about. Of the people that I've sponsored, the longest took about a year and a half, and the shortest took about 6 months. I averaged an hour a day for about 7 months. So having heard how much work that is, you might have forgotten the beautiful story of the sinner woman, about spiritual blindness, about the cup cleaning process, which sounded kind of cool about 5 minutes ago, right? You're probably thinking, did I say devote all of my heart to the Lord? Tell me a little bit more about that Zap recovery stuff. All kidding aside, you probably have some questions about this relationship that I'm talking about between resentment and self-indulgence. Am I really suggesting that any time you've ever experienced emotional discomfort, which lingered in the mind as the subject of contemplation, that this was the result of some form of self-indulgence? A lot of people get really upset by that suggestion. But what if I were to swap out the word self-indulgence with maybe self-focus? Would that make it a little bit easier to envision? To use this word would suggest that if you were capable of completely removing all focus from yourself, you'd be able to avoid altogether the experience of resentment. It would imply that if somebody wronged you, no matter how severe, if you were to think not of yourself but only of others, sorry, and instead remain focused entirely on loving them, so no focus on yourself at all, not at all, you couldn't experience resentment. It implies that you wouldn't be able to because you'd be too preoccupied with your concern for them. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's who we proclaim Jesus to be. He was so selfless that he took upon himself the consequences of our sinfulness in spite of the hatred and rejection that we cast upon him. I think it's important to acknowledge that he's the only one capable of that. All right. What about when the thing that lingers in your mind is the result of a time when you are absolutely the victim of something seriously wrong? This isn't a matter of justifying what the other person did. And it's definitely not suggesting that there's something wrong with being scarred or experiencing pain. Instead, what this is really about is being able to pull out the hooks that are in your heart that keep this painful experience anchored there. It's about being able to release it to God so you don't have to hang on to it, so that instead you experience the grace that is poured in. That's what this is about. All right. What about righteous anger? Because when I get resentful about something and I can't let it go, it's almost always because it's something evil, something the Lord would want me to hold in my mind. That's what happens when I get resentful. Certainly I don't have to write about that. Well, for that one, I'm going to have to question whether anyone really knows what real righteousness is, apart from God himself. I think he's the only one who gets to play the righteous anger card. I think that we only meet the requirements of righteousness in an adopted sense, in the sense that we're adopted into his family because of Christ's righteousness, because of what he did on the cross. That's how we can understand righteousness. Okay, well, what if it's something I've already dealt with? What if I no longer hold it in my mind as the subject of contemplation? Do I have to write about that too? Remember, guys, the big picture, the big picture point of this self-examination is to find all the self-indulgence you can so that you make as much room as possible in the cup to fill with God's grace. If you're going to do that, you can't limit your search to the stuff that's in the immediate sphere of your recollection. You got to go deep. The deeper you go, the more you get to surrender to God in exchange for the experience of his grace. The deeper you go, the more you experience his forgiveness. As you can imagine, there's a lot of questions that come up about this whole inventory process. I could give you a whole lot more. The stuff that I just shared with you, those questions, those are the basic ones, the common ones, the ones I always get asked. There's only so much that I can do from this stage. So what I want you to know is that if you have any questions, if you're interested in looking at this a little bit more, please call me, email me. My information's in the bulletin every single week. You know you can find me on Fridays in the church office before and after our recovery meeting. Meets from 5:30 to 6:30 in the church office. And what would be an absolute blessing would be if you joined us in our recovery ministry and you just went through a whole cycle of us going through the whole book, all the material, where we spend a lot of time about this stuff going in deep depth. So regarding the inventory technique, there's a number of different ways you can go about doing this. But the actual technique itself really doesn't matter. All that really matters is that whatever technique you employ helps you get to the indulgence, the self-indulgence at the core of your heart. That's what matters. When I sponsor individuals, I like to try to help them frame the totality of what they're going to be writing before they actually get started, because this is a really daunting task, as you might imagine. The idea is to create a burndown list, which can be used as a gauge to measure progress relative to an estimated end, so that there's a light at the end of the tunnel as you're going through this. So to create this list, you're to first make a list of every single person, place, or thing that you could even remotely associate with an event in which there was resentment. Next, for each entry on that list, you're to ask the question, have there been any events associated with this entry for each person on the list for which resentment actually resulted? If the answer is no, for this person I can't think of any resentful events, you cross them off the list. You're done. If the answer is yes, you list each event you can think of for which resentment can be associated. And you only need to list an event once, okay? Because I understand that when you experience resentment, there's usually multiple people. So you only need to list it once, all right? So keep that in mind. Once you've exhausted your list of people and associated events, you're ready to get started with the writing technique, beginning with the first person that's appearing on your list. Focusing on that person on your list, you're going to apply the writing technique to every single event that you listed. For each event, you're going to ask the question, of all the instances that comprise the mental replay of this event, which ones also resulted in resentment? You're going to list each one of those as well, using the writing format. So, on the night of the fight you got into, that's the event, what were the things that were said leading up to the fight? Certainly some of those resulted in resentment. Otherwise, the fight probably would have never happened. You're going to list every single thing you can recall. What about dirty looks? Did anyone give you that look? You know, the one that implied what they were thinking about you. You're going to write down each one of those as well using the technique. What else happened as a result of the fight? Was anything damaged? Were there legal troubles? Ruined relationships? You need to list every comprising detail which resulted in that event of resentment. What if you can't remember anything because this was like 20 years ago? Look, this is between you and God. Pray to him. Ask him to search your heart for any anxious thoughts. It's between you and him. Be honest. After finishing writing about an event, you cross it off the list and move on to the next in the exact same way. And you cross off all the events associated with a particular person, so you can cross them off. And you go on and on in this way until everybody's crossed off the list. Now you're writing about an event and you realize you forgot to include something. It's all right. Go back to the place that it belongs and insert it. This is going to happen. So did that sound complicated to you guys at all? We haven't even started talking about the writing technique. You ready? All right. After my sponsor first finished dropping the bomb about how extensive this task is, he moved on to begin teaching me about this writing technique. Now, really learning this technique requires practice, review, correction, over and over and over with a teacher. My sponsor and I did this dance for about 3 weeks. Once he felt I had the hang of it, he said, go. Write about all the embarrassment, anger, frustration, anxiety, fear, paranoia, regret, and all the other types of deep discomfort that linger in your mind until you're done. And then we'll go on to the next step. Sounds crazy, right? Well, unfortunately, I didn't have the luxury of taking any more chances. This was the deal. Either spend an hour a day writing about myself to begin experiencing the transforming depths of the Spirit, or get back on the happy road to suicide. It wasn't that really of a tough decision for me. Now, about this writing format. From up here on this stage, all I can give you are the basics. 10 minutes just isn't going to be enough time. But nonetheless, to begin with, let's start the conversation by revisiting this idea of an event. An event which resulted in resentment. I found that it's helpful to regard a single event as a weed. Now, when you think of a weed, not the kind you smoke, we're going to assume that a weed consists of three parts. One, leaves, the stem and trunk, stems and trunk, and roots. Each of these parts represents something. The leaves of the weed represent all of those little details that in and of themselves resulted in resentment. One leaf represents the dirty look that John gave you on the night of the fight. Another leaf represents the thing that your brother said. Another represents that moment when Alex threw his drink in your face, and on, until you've listed all of the resentful incidents comprising the fight, or whatever event you're writing about. When you consider all of the leaves collectively, they come together to form the weed in the exact same way that the individual incidents come together to form the event. So what connects all of these leaves together? We'll say that what holds them together so that they collectively form a weed, are the stems and maybe a trunk. Regarding our event of resentment, let's say that the stems and trunk represent fears or concerns. Up to this point, I haven't actually said anything about fear, but this is a really critical part of the inventory. For each event that we list and break down, we have to find the fears associated with each of the comprising incidents. The fears associated with those. I'd like to suggest that without these fears or concerns, the incidents would have never amounted to anything worth remembering. As an example, imagine that you're walking down the street minding your own business, and somebody says to you at random, "You messed up." Let's assume these words were said to you by a complete stranger, and that you couldn't care anything any less about what this stranger or anybody who heard thinks. Would these words affect you in any way? Probably not. There's no concern. There's no fear. Now, what if these same words were said to you by your mother, who only ever criticizes you, who's never said a good thing about you and never does? And when she said those words, you were just trying to do something nice for her. What types of concerns might there be? What types of fears might there be? Fears that are in the form of assumption. Assumptions about what she's implying or what she thinks about you. Does this interaction cast doubts about if she even loves you? Is she implying that I'm stupid, that I can't do anything right? Is she totally disregarding the fact that I'm doing this to show her love? Doesn't she care about me? Does she only care about herself? Now, maybe you didn't consciously articulate these thoughts in words in your mind, but you felt them in the resentment. The task is to explore them, to ask, why did this comment sting? Does it imply something deeper? What does it imply she thinks of you? These are the types of questions you ask yourself as you inventory every single incident, every single leave. So if the wind were to blow at what appeared to be a weed, but the leaves of the weed weren't connected to anything, they'd simply be carried away by the wind. Likewise, if there are fears or concerns about the implications behind what something says or does, they too would also fade away without effect. So this brings us to the roots of the weed. This is what we're really after, right? The roots represent the various forms of self-indulgence or self-focus that are at the root of the resentment. If it were humanly possible for you to be completely selfless, the words said by your mother could have no effect. They'd be nothing more than words carried off by the wind. Because without self-focus, you could never even consider what they imply about you, because your focus would be on loving others. Without roots, a weed withers and dies. Out of curiosity, what do you guys think that the terrain represents? It's the heart. Those weeds are anchored in the heart. And we want to be able to take inventory of them. We want to learn how to find them, so that we can show them to the gardener, so that he can uproot them and put in their place his vine, which bears his fruit. This weed analogy is actually very significant. It represents all of the things that you need to consider for every event of resentment that you're going to write about. You need to list all of the contributing incidents of the resentment, symbolized by the weeds. For each incident, you need to consider the underlying fears, connecting the leaves to the roots, the stems and trunk. And for everything listed, leaves and stems alike, you need to list the particular forms of self-indulgence at their root. So finally, the writing technique. For each event that you write about, you're simply going to list them out with their associated fears, one right after the other, in a list format. In doing so, you're going to be using a sheet of paper that's divided into three columns, like the one you see over here. When listing an incident on this paper, it's going to be sorted across the three columns. In the first column, pretty simple. You enter the name of the person or institution at which you're resentful. It's usually Kevin, who's not here right now. That's more for me to write about. Your name will likely appear in this column quite often. Within the second column, you're going to enter the incident that was enacted by Kevin. When writing it out, write it as though you're completing the following sentence. I'm resentful at Kevin for, you fill in the blank. So the first word of that entry that fills in the blank, it's going to end with ing. That's the format, all right? It's going to be a verb. I'm resentful at Kevin for hitting, thinking, looking, saying, telling, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. These are going to be succinct statements. They're not going to be really elaborate. If you find that you're writing a lot in one line, you probably need to break that down into multiple lines. Within the third column, you're to list the forms of self-indulgence that are at the root of that particular entry you just listed. In my case, I was to choose from a list of 14, which are on that sheet, so that I don't forget. Pride, self-pity, self-centeredness, dishonesty, lust, sloth, arrogance, selfishness, greed, envy, jealousy, impatience, gluttony, and intolerance. I was to understand and learn from my teacher how those were the roots of those resentment. It was an amazing experience. Now, there are rules for when to apply each one of these, but I can't go through that with you. I've got like 5 more minutes. I could spend a whole sermon on that. But what I will do is I'll share with you the 4 that my sponsor said belong with every entry on the list. Beginning with self-centeredness. Well, we already said that without focus on self, there couldn't be any resentment. But let's consider my favorite flavor of self-centeredness, the kind that results in fears or assumptions about what others are thinking of you because you did something embarrassing. There you are in class, and you accidentally blasted a fart. Oh my gosh, I'm so embarrassed. I list every person that I really think heard it and what they think of me. I list what they thought of me, how my reputation is ruined. This type of resentment is extremely self-centered. I think I'm so important that people are actually going to spend their own time thinking about me for more than a millisecond. Realistically, guys, farts are just funny. If birds farted instead of chirped, we'd all laugh a lot more. Pride. I like to define pride as the worship of one's own image. And I'm not talking about the physical image. I'm talking the image that I want you to perceive. This form of idolatry causes me to do and say things specifically so that you will perceive me a certain way. In this sense, manipulation becomes the chisel that I use to form the graven image. Now, if you dare do something to misrepresent my image, if you dare think otherwise, what do you think is going to happen? Resentment. So when I farted, my pride was definitely injured. What about dishonesty? Sometimes this is a really one to associate with resentment, especially when you're talking about lying, cheating, or stealing, what we call cash register dishonesty. But what about what about my favorite flavor, which is in the form of hypocrisy? Somebody does something. It annoys you. God, I hate it when they do that. Yet, it's something that you yourself are guilty of doing in some way, shape, or form. And yet it annoys you. There's some dishonest hypocrisy in that. And lastly, self-pity. This one usually comes in the form of poor me, or I don't deserve this. But something really unique about this particular flavor of self-indulgence is that it can be really deceptive and dangerous. It can take something like healthy grieving and turn it into something really dangerous, where the person becomes so self-absorbed in that feeling that they start justifying really unhealthy behavior, such as cutting, suicide, self-inflicted pain. Not until they're able to break the focus from themselves are they able to snap out of it. A great weapon against this is serving others. So as you can imagine, there's a lot you learn about yourself when you go through this, when you're led through it by somebody who's also done it. I can tell you from my experience, my eyes were just open super wide. I learned just how blind I was and am. And I only began to see a little, but just that little bit, wow, how amazing. And even more amazing was when I shared it with my sponsor in the fifth step, when I shared it with God, and he began to remove it from the cup. So, as a closing thought, what do you guys think this has to do with addiction or relapse? This is a sermon series for them, isn't it? Well, actually, this one really does have a lot to do with relapse. Think about it. The result of self-indulgence is resentment. And whenever I'm experiencing resentment, I have a desire to escape. Now, if I'm an addict or an alcoholic, there's a lot of risk with that. Death and destruction aren't far away. So cleaning the inside of the cup is taking the battle to the source. It's taking it to the heart. Well, I recognize that this is a really full sermon. A lot of details thrown at you guys. If you're interested in going a little deeper with this, please reach out to me. I'd be happy to give you a copy of the transcript. I'd be happy to sit down and talk with you. My info is in the bulletin. I love this stuff, guys. Please, indulge me.